Hey, Gamers, this is Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire, and I'm here with a very special guest this week, somebody whose work I've really enjoyed reading, and now we're finally talking to each other face-to-face. It is Dan Thoreau, also known as Space Biff. How you doing, Dan?
Apprehensive. How are you?
Apprehensive? How dare you? I'm doing great.
I'm intimidated.
I twisted his arm to come on here, everyone. It was a work.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to speak with you.
Yeah, this is going to be great. So we're actually going to be doing a double episode. So in this episode, I will be pestering Dan, which is why he's apprehensive. And then next episode, he will be interrogating me, except I don't actually think it's going to be interrogation. I think it's going to be just fine.
I have some tough questions.
I will have some bad answers. But let's start with you. So I sort of feel like your main reputation is as somebody who writes very thoughtful, kind of high intellectual board game reviews. Is that something that you intended to do, or have your reviews evolved over time?
That's a great question. Yeah, it would be the evolved side of things. So when I started writing, as some people probably know, I actually have my background in academia, and so I still do. A lot of very dry academic writing. That's pretty much, that's 80% of the writing I do. And so I found myself, even in my personal writing, not using contractions and like using footnotes. And I just realized I shouldn't send emails with footnotes and I should let myself use contractions. And growing up, I always wanted to write, and I love writing. And so I started Space Biff with the sole express purpose of I need to write something that is not dry academic writing every day, all day. And so at first I just, you know, I didn't even write about board games. I just sort of wrote a blog. And then eventually when I got into board games, courtesy of my wife, I began writing about board games the way I saw everyone else writing about it. So I'd be like, okay, here's a board game and here's the components and here's the rules. And then here's what I think. And I did get bored with that pretty quickly. And I've always loved reading criticism. And so I just started applying what I saw as critical techniques in other mediums to board games. So now we've reached the point where I do want every review to at least be thoughtful in a way that maybe some other things are not thoughtful or not reflexively thoughtful. And so now that's what I do. And it's still very much developing. Like sometimes I go back and look at my work from even a year or two ago and I go, oh, look at this dummy. And I am, so it's always evolving. And I think that is, to me anyway, that's what I always want my work to be anyway, is always developing and always changing. So that's the easy answer. How about you? How did you always want to be one of the most thoughtful podcasters, or how did you get there?
So my podcast was actually the product of quarantine boredom. It started in May of 2020. So what's really interesting is that, you can, if you go back to the very earliest archives of my blog, you can tell that I want to talk about board games, but I'm kind of unfocused, if that makes sense.
Sure.
The posts aren't regular. There's no specific format. I'm just kind of throwing things out there into the ether. And I feel like my own work has also changed a lot over the years. You know, I look at my early YouTube videos and cringe. I think we all do that, you know.
Yeah.
But my writing in particular, you know, I used to think more about just, is my review useful to somebody in terms of whether they should, you know, pick up this game or not, because I feel like that's what a lot of people seem to want from reviewers. But over time, it's become increasingly clear that that's not actually what I want, if that makes sense. And sure. So I wanted to participate in the community in a way that I thought our community would appreciate. But now it's kind of like, well, where am I in this? And so, mm-hmm. you know, I feel like my podcast really reflects stuff that I feel like talking about. And I'm still reworking how I want that to look in my playthroughs and in my reviews. And I think that you can also see it in my strong swing towards historical gaming and wargaming. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it's easier for me to latch on intellectually to those games and pull more out of them than did I like this or not. And that's a major part of the attraction for me. Is that true for you as well? Like, I think we're both Omni gamers, but I definitely know you more for your coverage of war and historical games.
Yeah, I do believe, kind of at a critical level, that like when I write about games at the end of the year, like what was the best game of the year, I tend to be very big on the idea that like the most complicated, in-depth, you know, polemical board game that I played, I do rank them alongside like a tiny solo game that's just a deck of cards. I tend to not make distinctions like that. And I think that if you're enthusiastic about a game, like here's what I mean. So sometimes I see people like love a game, but it's small. And so they'll go on Board Game Geek and they'll be like, they'll rate it an 8. and it's because it's like small. And I just don't think format matters all that much. So that's at a critical level. So that's why I tend to rate things regardless of their format as being things that can be rated alongside each other. But as for historical games, yeah, I think we are alike in the sense that I wish we could talk about historical games at a better level, that we could push that discourse a little bit.
Yes.
And there's this opinion that like, why are you such a scold? And most of the time I don't get that opinion, but there is why aren't games just about fun? And I'm going, well, this is fun to me.
Yes.
This is what I like to do. And I like considering board games at that historical level. And that historical level is not, why are there brown cubes in Puerto Rico? I know that's the example that gets brought out now and then. The example is more, what are the victory conditions in Puerto Rico and what do those say about the game? So are your thoughts similar?
Yeah, I'm very much of the opinion that there's no such thing as just a game and that games are not just for fun. I think that even something like Azul, if you knew how to look at it with the right perspective, right, would tell you something about our society, what's important to us, what we like. And you know, every game that we make is an artifact, especially with all the plastic, to be real, that some archaeologists may someday find, and they will look at those things and wonder about us and what we were like and what was important to us. And even if we can't always see it, I think that our games are telling us things about ourselves and about our culture that, you know, if we but had the ears to listen, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that historical games kind of bring that out more, because when you do history, it's easier to see the layers, right? Because there's the layer where we're talking about history, and then there's the layer where we decided that this history was important to enact ourselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, being able to see the layers better, I feel like gives me that more reflective experience. That's not to say I don't like small games, because I do. I've got Agropolis in my bag waiting to go right now. I think Azul is beautiful. I still love Splendor, honestly. I teach that to my kids every year.
Yeah.
In terms of most played game, it's probably Splendor, actually.
Right.
But, you know, I'm looking for that heavier thing to talk about. I'm going to go to a historical game for that. Does that make sense?
Of course, yeah.
So one thing you've changed, so speaking of evolution of your reviews, you have stopped, you don't post the rating except on BGG, right? If that's what I recall, like it's not ever on the review. And you also no longer talk about price. So what is the reasoning behind those choices? I've always been curious about that.
So those are very, to me, those are very different, though, of course, they are connected concepts. So with ratings, the main reason I post them to Board Game Geek is, this is going to sound so cynical.
It's okay.
It's visibility. And the problem is I always look at those ratings whenever I go back and I'm like, no, that's wrong. And I any game, I look at the rating and I change it. And so I kind of have a hands-off policy that I don't look at my own ratings anymore. And that's why I don't rate games on my site. I'm sure that there are people for whom that has real meaning. I know that there are, because they email me and they're like, why did you give this a 7 instead of an 8? And I'm like, I don't know. that's what it felt like when I rated it in light of the other ratings as well. I don't know. But to me, numbers are just so abstract. I'm not good at math. That's the reason for that. It's just crass marketability that I put it on Board Game Geek. By extension, why I don't put it on my site is I just don't think numbers mean anything compared to the text. And, you know, I found very early on in reading criticism that anything that rates, I don't look at the text. I just scroll down to the end and look at the number. Like a new video game comes out that I'm curious about. I just kind of like go to IGN or PC Gamer or whatever and look at the number. And I don't even believe the number means anything.
Yeah.
And I'm still doing that, even though I'm like a big, the text is what matters kind of person. And so I just don't even put in the temptation. The price thing, that's such a loaded conversation because I've received some very nasty comments about it. some people were very upset when I wrote that. And I don't think that all of their statements were necessarily unjustified. I think that, you know, some people expressed a frustration that, you know, what if you read about this board game and it sparks interest in you and then you find out that it's expensive, prohibitively expensive, or even worse, because sometimes I review board games that are not technically available. Mm-hmm. What if you find out you can't buy it? And I get that. And I get that in part because our hobby is geared toward viewing these things. You know, there are many identities for a game. The very mm-hmm. fact that we think of them as, is it good? That shows we're thinking about it under a quality label. But we also predominantly view them as products. You know, so people want to know, can I buy it and for how much? And is it worth it for $40, but not $50? And I don't think that's actually a useful label that we sort games through. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually corrosive. And so for me, the reason I don't talk about price is because I want to get away from that. I want my review to be relevant whether or not you have... whether you're buying a game or whether you're just thinking of playing it just once at a friend's house or a game store. I want my review to be relevant 10 years after its publication when it's out of print. You know, I don't think that the commercial angle is always useful. That isn't to say I don't think it is useful.
Right.
I just think that it's so ubiquitous that basically everybody is talking about price. And I think that reviewers should at least consider the possibility that you don't need to be an instrument of selling the board game. You can be more than that or parallel to that. You can be orthogonal to it. You can be something else.
I want to come back to this thought, but I actually don't disagree with you. I do mention price sometimes, but mm-hmm. I only mention price when I feel that it's actually high enough typically to mention, or so low and the game's great that it's like, wow, you might as well just try it because really, like, there's no barrier. So something like, I don't know, like, I love Chip Theory. Their games are expensive. I'm gonna warn people, if you get attached to the idea of playing this, get ready to drop money because it's so expensive that it's, you know, you could get sticker shock. Other than that, I've actually just never mentioned it and nobody's ever made a big thing out of it. So I wonder if you had just not mentioned it ever again, if anybody would have said anything.
You know, I think not, because ironically, I had decided like 3 years earlier, 2 or 3 years earlier, to never mention price. And no one complained until I pointed out that I was doing it. like, no one was ever like, you recommended this game and it was $200, so I'm mad at you. No one ever once brought that up. And then I say, I don't talk about price, and suddenly everyone's panicking. Which I should probably think more about. What does that mean? I'm not sure.
That's actually interesting, because I also think about things like a restaurant review, right? I don't remember I've ever read a restaurant review where somebody told me how much they paid for the food. Does that make sense? They talk yeah. about the food and its quality and the service and the preparation and, you know, the flavor combos and all that kind of stuff, but never the price. And I've also never read, I mean, books have standardized prices, right? But I've never seen someone say, well, this would be worth it to me to pick this book up used, but I would never buy it hardcover. Like, I've never seen a comment like that in a book review, I don't think.
Yeah. And with book reviews, I think it's, I've received a lot of statements like, you know, the difference is that a board game could be, you know, it could be $10 or it could be $100.
Whereas, so could a book. Has anybody looked at book, Braille yeah, publishing recently?
They're like, books or films are standardized. And I'm going, only if you're kind of taking a narrow perspective on, you're assuming a lot about what I want to view or read. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the things I want to see are basically only at film festivals, which means I'm paying thousands of dollars potentially, you know, to like fly to Venice, you know, or something like that. Or books where, you know, just maybe this is part of my background, but a lot of the times I want to read a book that is kind of a thick, it was only published in hardback, it's hard to get, it's out of print. I'm going to be paying at least $80 for that at a secondhand shop. Mm-hmm. It's not online. It's never been digitized. And so that kind of makes a big assumption about what I want to listen to or view or read. Or even with regular books. I mean, I don't know if some people are aware of this, but most books you can read for free.
It's true. If you're willing to wait.
Library. And in fact, most of the books I read are from my library, and at no point have I read a book review where it said like, this is a library read, not a purchase read, you know, there's, you know, just the statement on the book should be relevant regardless of how, of my economic situation that prompts me to get it from the university library versus, you know, buying a paperback for, and, you know, is it a mass trade paperback versus the, you know, $15 paperback versus the $30 hardcover? No one is telling me which copy of this book to buy unless it's a translation or something.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely, the translation point's a good point, but we will move on. I also really liked what you were saying earlier, though, about kind of resisting the idea of board game as product in your criticism. Do you find that difficult to do? I mean, you and I both kind of cringe at the use of the word content to describe our work. Yeah. I know that you and I both treasure honest reviews, but we're also reviewing board games, which means that we have relationships with publishers and with designers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are people who are making a living off of the products that we are playing and reviewing. Do you find it hard to separate? How do you manage it?
It is hard to separate. And sometimes it's, sometimes I think that there is an element where I feel badly. Okay. Yeah. I'll put it this way. I'll just say it. So, you know, the big thing is previews for me, right? That people will say, I have a board game coming out and the way that they're going to make the most money isn't a review. It's if I write about it before the game comes out, because mm-hmm. it's going to be on crowdfunding or whatever. So I try not to do too many previews. I try to limit myself to one every 1 or 2 months. And for the most part, I try to do previews of projects that I feel like kind of need the extra boost. They look interesting. They're historical. Maybe they're making an argument, stuff like that. Then there are projects that, because by dint of it being a preview, so they send it to me in advance, they want a preview. And just in the last 2 months, I have been sent 3 of these games and I didn't like them. That isn't to say they were bad. And I won't say what they were. And I've had to, you know, I have felt that temptation to just kind of write an airy, non-committal, you know, as uneditorial as possible preview where I'm like, and here's what the game does, and this part's good, and sort of be muted about the negative parts.
Right.
And in all 3 cases, this instance, I just ended up writing the designer and saying, I don't want to. I don't like it. I don't think I can say positive things about it. I'll send it back to you. I'll send it to another writer or video person, you know, whatever you would prefer, but I can't write about this.
Yeah.
And that's hard. It is. I'm not going to pretend it isn't. I feel like in two of those instances, I may have burned a bridge. I don't think those designers are going to want to send me review copies in the future. And that's absolutely their prerogative.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I totally get it. I don't, you know, I never think that I am owed a review copy, so I get it. And in their eyes, I'm probably flaky or something. You know, even though in each of these cases, I did try their game, I played it at least three times, and it wasn't something I was going to be able to write about. So there is that tension, with regarding these things as products. And it is something that, you know, sometimes I've seen, you know, there's kind of that brand of maverick reviewer where they're like, I don't care about, you know, connections with the industry. I do.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to lie to you by being like, I never care. No, I do. And that is difficult to navigate. And to me, that's kind of the core of ethical behavior, is we don't talk about ethical behavior because it's easy. We talk about it because it's hard. That certain standards are difficult to enforce, not on others, but in ourselves. Yeah, it's hard. And I honestly, it has to be taken case by case for me. Does that answer your question, or is that a bad answer?
No, I actually think that's a really good answer, because I think that making the point that, yes, we talk about ethics because it's hard, I think a lot of people think there's just a really easy answer for a lot of these kinds of questions. Like, oh, you just got to grow up and not care. But, like, I also care. I feel really bad when I write negative reviews. It doesn't stop me, because I feel my feeling of moral obligation, to be honest, is stronger than my desire to please at this point in my life.
Mm-hmm, sure.
But, you know, that's, you know, that doesn't mean that I don't have my moments where it's really hard. And I actually think that talking about previews is interesting. Like, I've actually almost entirely quit doing previews. I did one for Hoplomachus Victorum. I already knew I was going to like it because I love Hoplo. Like, there's no question mm-hmm. that I was going to feel okay promoting it. But, you know, I've become increasingly, like, I have a really hard time with doing marketing. And the problem is that people send you review copies as part of their marketing budget. It's not part of their, this is my art and I want critics to receive my art.
Right.
This is my marketing budget. And I think it's hard to, I think you and I must probably both struggle with this. It's hard to see yourself as a critic who's trying to push for that higher plane of what we want to talk about, while also feeling like we need to meet the needs of the market and, you know, and of the publishers who are waiting for what we thought. If that makes sense.
You know, and you used a great phrase in there where at this point in your life, you feel that way.
Yeah.
And for me, at this point in my life, I also feel that way. I feel a huge obligation to myself and to my audience, and also to this cultural artifact, this board game, to yes. telling the truth about it. But I can't say that I have always felt that obligation at every point in my life. And that's one reason why I feel like we need to have a few very uncomfortable conversations, even conversations that unfortunately are going to be co-opted by, or at least attempted to be co-opted by, some bad actors. Because I think we need to have a few ethical discussions, not so that we can bash people,
right.
but so that people who are kind of coming in who aren't at that place in their lives can see that standard. And have that encouragement, because we do create a culture with the things we talk about and with the way we behave. And so to me, it's important to come into this industry and say, I have a standard that I'm not going to just market these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to try to talk about these things as, does it have its, are my daughters being super loud in the background?
Yes, but I find it charming. So everybody else.
Oh, okay. They've decided to play right there. But, you know, set that standard that, you know, we talk about these things on their own merits.
Right.
We talk about these things according to certain criteria. And that's one reason why when I wrote my article about price, I took kind of a hard line with it. Because I want to see us have that culture where you are not expected to sell a product.
Right.
Whereas currently you are very much expected to sell a product. Now, I don't think that that's invaluable, right? A commercial review can be valuable. It's just that I don't think it's valuable when everything is a commercial review. And I want to see there be enough people who are talking about games on, you know, according to different criteria, that if somebody is coming into this scene and somebody's thinking, well, I want to write or create, you know, do podcasts or produce videos about board games, that their first instinct isn't, here's how you do it, is you sell products and you do a bunch of previews and they're all positive. I want somebody to come in and the culture that they see has an alternative where they can say, I want to talk about this as culture, or I want to talk about this as art, or I want to talk about this as discursive history. You know, I want there to be that alternative. And currently, I don't think there is. Unless you know, like, a very specific group of people.
I would say that that's true. And also, you're right to be apprehensive. You've walked into my trap. No, okay. I really... So I like what you said, though. I really believe this, right? That we create a culture. We create a culture. The contributions that we are choosing to make to the industry, to the people who read our work, to anybody who might stumble upon it in the future, we are creating a culture. So what are you deliberately working to create in your reviews, and how would you say that somebody could see it if they went back and looked?
You know, for me personally, a lot of my focus is on, so I already said that I think, okay, I think they're exiting. I won't apologize for my daughters being lovely.
Nor should you.
So the culture that I personally am working to create, and I think that you can see this in some of my writing, is just this idea that I want to talk about board games. So speaking very broadly, right, I want to talk about games as though they are agents of a culture. And that can apply at kind of different levels. So at the low level, is a board game, is it going to try to do something that is appreciable? And that can mean fun. Sure, it can mean fun. It can mean safe. It can mean that it takes a particular tone. Moving up the rung, though, you can also see, is this board game trying to, if it's going to be about a serious issue, is it trying to depict that issue seriously? Is it trying to be honest? Is it trying to have some sense of obligation to its topic?
Right.
Now, and not every board game is going to have that same obligation. But I think that every game is going to have some sort of, you know, is it meeting its goals or the goals it should have? Right. So with a historical game, one thing I've pointed out quite a few times is I don't have a problem actually with any individual. So I've written a lot recently about colonialism and board games. I have no problem with any individual title that is just kind of this, you know, there's nothing there, you know, that it erases things, or it's the indigenous are kind of there, but not really there, or not well rounded out or depicted that well. My issue isn't with individual titles. My issue is with the fact that all of these titles in aggregate just leave nothing where there were cultures or peoples, or where there were acts like genocide or pillage, that they that taken together, they create this impression that becomes history. That history is very much, to me, history is a conflict. It's a conflict of perception. And you can see this all over the place. Even in, you know, you study ancient history, and a major task for modern historians is picking through what's propaganda and perception versus what's real.
Oh, yeah.
And people who aren't historians tend to not know that. Now, so you, of course, are a very accomplished student of history. And so I'm sure that that's something you know all too well. I mean, do you find that, so one conversation we had, one of our first conversations, is that you've studied, for instance, the Coptic Church.
Yeah.
And most Christians in America know bupkis about Coptic Christianity. So what would you say? Where is that useful at all? Is that something you're trying to, I assume from your own series that you've recently completed, that that's something that's on your mind as well?
Yeah, I think that, so actually this is where I wanted to go anyway, because, you know, we talked about rating kind of more simple games on the same scale as more complex ones. But I do think that when someone is making a historical claim in a game, even if it's a bad historical claim, even if it's kind of a shallow historical claim, you have put yourself in a place where you owe more in terms of accuracy and respect and kind of treatment of the subject than you owe when you've made a splendor, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Something that's more abstract. And for me, it's not that a historical game is inherently better than a simple one in any way. In fact, I would say that's largely untrue. Historical games, I think, carry more weight on their shoulders because whether they intend to or not, they are making statements about the period in which they are set. And I think that pretending that that's not the case is actually pretty dangerous. Actually, one thing that does sort of disappoint me sometimes is that, you know, when we talk about Christianity in the United States, especially, right? Like, we're very, very Western centric about it. But actually, all those creeds that people are saying in church every Sunday were written by a bunch of Middle Eastern dudes, and Rome was barely in the mix at the time because the cultural center of the world was Constantinople.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's amazing to me too that, like, you know, people look at conflict in the Middle East and everyone forgets that there are sizable Christian populations there who, you know, if we're going to fight about authenticity, have a very good claim to, you know, an unbroken historical tradition or to, you know, their own individual belief sets. You know, the Coptic Church has different Christological views than the Catholic Church in the United States, but they also share a lot of common history, a lot of, you know, liturgical patterning. You know, I think that it's not just the history that you choose to write and how you do it. It's like what topics you're choosing. The things that you leave out, it's almost as if they don't exist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And would I feel comfortable making a game about Coptic monks or something? Maybe. I know that as a secular person with a very scholarly view on the matter, that people who are actually practicing Copts might be upset by what I had to make or what I had to say. And I would have to think really hard about that if I were going to push it myself.
Yeah.
That said, you know, I feel like there's not, a lot of times our games don't have enough perspective. Like, look how many World War II games there are versus any other kind of historical game available at all. I mean, it's not just about what you make, it's about what you're not making.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a great way to put that.
So how do you choose to hold a game to historical standards? Like, if it's just got sort of a pasted on theme, how much does that matter to you? Does that annoy you in some way? Or do you feel like you can't really start to seriously engage with the game until it's gotten more overt about what it's trying to do historically?
You know, that's a great question because it's something I'm still wrestling with. I mean, to me, there's kind of three delineations. I mean, there's like a game like the lowest rung is Splendor, a game like that, where you've got this kind of like, it's like Renaissance traders, but at no point in the game is anyone going like, oh, this is what Renaissance trading was like. You know, no one is, no one is fooled. No one is under any false impression. You know, no one's going to go to their Renaissance class in college and think that they could like include Splendor as a footnote. You know, no one's under that impression.
Right.
And then there's kind of this Euro game where the game is very much about a purity of system and mechanics and optimization. And that uses a historical theme versus a war game or a conflict sim, which is trying to be very explicitly historical. And so for me, that middle one is where I'm really not sure where I stand, to be honest. So I was speaking with a friend just yesterday, actually, about a game I've never played, which is Great Western Trail. Have you played Great Western Trail?
I have not. I've seen it laid out. I've watched other people play part of it, never played it.
And I keep wanting to play it because to me, one of the things I've heard about it, so I hear it's getting a new edition that's maybe more sensitive or something like that. To me, that's super interesting because we're talking about like, where is Pfister from? Isn't he German?
I believe so. Yeah.
Where, you know, I have some German acquaintances who are super into Westerns and cowboys.
Yes.
And so then, so we have this German who's making a Western, which is really, so we're already, as a historian, I can't help but look at the lenses through which this thing is being created, because we're looking at a non-American who isn't necessarily aware of some of the problems that, you know, are contemporary discussion points here in the United States and in Canada. So he's making this through a lens of German appreciation of Westerns, which itself was created through a lens that we as Americans, at least historically, gave him because of we're the ones who wrote the Western books. We're the ones who created Hollywood, which made this kind of very white version of the Western. And now that he creates this Western, we turn around and we go, well, how insensitive of you. And so it's hard for me to not look at that and be like, I actually think that the complicity here isn't that he didn't research.
Right.
I think there is that element, maybe, you know, that he maybe should have researched more. But there's also the complicity that goes back decades that is very American.
That, oh, yeah.
That, you know, he's seeing this already through two lenses, at least, that he has no control over. And can he make a board game and escape the scrutiny of, you know, Western critics who are like, oh, you whitewashed this. How awful of you.
Right.
And I can see him being like, I what?
Yeah.
And not even knowing what he doesn't know. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I have a weird aside about this, which is that in my reading German class, because I had to pass German reading exams for grad school, fun times, we actually had a unit about Westerns that were written in Germany for Germans that were very popular and that, you know, very much like did the sort of noble savage thing about Native
Americans
in the United States. And it's not even ill-intentioned, but we basically exported an incorrect idea about what was going on here. And then it got refracted through yet another foreign lens. And yeah, I mean, culturally in Germany, you might think it's perfectly normal to talk about sort of cowboys and Indians in the old style. That's not okay in the United States anymore. Does that mean that you don't research? No, but you might not think to, actually.
Right. And to me, that's one of the reasons why I feel like a professional critic owes more to the artifact of a game than just being like, oh, this is problematic. I don't like that word in the first place. I don't think it actually says much. But like Great Western Trail, I think one of the tasks of a critic, if they really want to dive into that, is to say, okay, so this game is operating on a number of assumptions. And for those who are going to get mad at me, again, I am not actually critiquing Great Western Trail right now. I've never played it. This is just a discussion I had with a friend. But if we're going to critique and say, oh, how insensitive, I think actually we owe it to ourselves and to the designer and to the game and the audience to peel into it a little bit more than, oh, this is insensitive or, oh, this is erasure.
Right.
To look at why is it erasure? And who is really creating that erasure? Because we're talking about, you know, I'm so glad that you brought up reading German Westerns, because in my, when I took fourth semester German, we were given the option of reading either a fairy tale or a German Western. And I picked the fairy tale and I've always regretted it. Because yeah, we're talking about multiple traditions and how they've been filtered through an imperial lens and a propagandist lens, and now a cultural lens that's German that has no desire. It's innocent. You know, it has no desire to malign anyone.
Right.
And is Pfister working through that lens? And if so, what affordance should be given to the work? And I think there is some affordance that should be given to it. That doesn't to say that if they want to release an edition that's more sensitive, I don't think that's wrong either. So, that's great that it's also developing that, you know, upon realizing that maybe there was a mistake made there that they want to do better. That's great too. But so I think that all of this is just to say it's complicated, and I'm still working through my own feelings, especially with those, that middle category, like a Euro game that's just historical.
Yeah.
whatever that means.
I'm still working through it too. I think a lot of the line for me is, what are you claiming to be in the rules on the box in the flavor text?
Yeah.
I think that the moment you're like, oh, we looked at the real art of this period and we brought out this real thing through our game. Like at that point, you're dancing on the line where like, I really hope that you did your homework because you're accountable for it now. Does that make sense?
Sure.
I also think that we may need to think more about that anyway, because I think some of our biggest discussions about things like cultural appropriation, right, have happened through these Euros that people see as sort of sterile. And as, you know, oh, it's just a, we just need a flavor to put this perfectly mathematical and, you know, pure engineering system into to give it a little bit of, you know, artistic value and just make it a little more interesting. And at that point, one, you're using marketing needs to drive possibly like pasting on things that don't need to be pasted onto a Euro game.
Yeah.
But two, I think you're being a little bit disingenuous in the sense that like not... Even math, I don't know a lot. I'm not good at math either. But my suspicion is that nothing is pure logic, not even math. Why else would there be so much drama between mathematicians, right? Like everything, there is no such thing as a pure engineering gaming system that can just be pasted on with any theme that in a way that could not offend anyone because it's just so pure and so abstract. Because once you put the theme on, it's not abstract anymore. It has a theme.
Yeah.
Like, it just feels more okay to do it about medieval Europe because people don't have the same emotional attachments to medieval Europe anymore.
Right.
We all just feel like a sense of communal ownership over it.
Right. Well, and ironically, I think this leads to a situation where, for me, the games that are hardest to parse and the most troublesome are not war games. Where, to me, I assume at least... with a war game that there's some degree of fidelity to the history. And
right.
And usually, you know, you get designer notes where they will actually like walk you through the assumptions they're making. And then I recently wrote an article, for instance, talking about two of Martin Wallace's games where he uses the Cthulhu mythos, you know, Lovecraft's work, in order to intentionally other particular people and make them okay to kill. And in the first instance, the game is A Study in Emerald, where the people being othered are the royalty of Europe. And so it's giving you permission to basically be an anarchist in the 19th century and throw dynamite at, you know, the passing royal carriage. And you can do that in a guilt-free environment. And then the other one, though, is Australia, with a Z, Australia, where the game is you're colonizing Australia. And so the aliens are just in Australia, and it seems like they're a stand-in for the indigenous. So it's
right.
Making colonialism appropriate. And so to me, the question looking into that is like, okay, so in which condition is this okay? In which condition is this making a useful argument? That's hard to pick through. Whereas I look at a war game, and it's just like, here, you're colonizing Australia and you're getting a little tiny bit of indigenous pushback. I just assume, okay, well, you're trying to have fidelity. Whereas
right.
It's this Euro game that's about a system where I'm more like, what? What's going on here?
Right.
And so that's why one of the reasons I say I'm still picking through it. And I love your definition here where you're saying that the discursive rhetoric of the rule book helps to pick into that, because you're very right that I do look at the rule book and what they're trying to say.
Right.
Because if it's like, this is Catan and here's an island that basically has no one on it, then I'm like, oh, okay. That's rare.
Yeah. I think what makes it interesting though is like, okay, the problem is that for future historians or for us as people picking apart our own culture, right? I think that the most interesting argument is the one you don't know you're making. Like so much mm-hmm. of historical work, right, is looking at things that are ancient propaganda or at things that are from different people who have different cultural assumptions. And
yeah.
being able to look at their stuff in contrast and think, oh, here's like a little fault line. Here's a pulse point that I can press and something about this culture will be revealed to me by doing that. Does that make sense? But then mm-hmm. in board games, it's almost harder to do from within our own society, especially because you and I are both white people who live in the West, who live in the United States. Like there's perspectives that we can't kind of torque our way out of in order to get the best possible read on a game. We just don't have enough distance.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that that's where it's the most interesting to try. You know, for historical games, I think the argument of interest comes from kind of, you know, assessing the history itself, And then why were you interested in that? What is it that you were asking the player to do? What role are you giving them historically? And what does that say about the player of the game and about you as the designer and about the experience and the memories of a historical simulation that you're going to have after your experience of that game? And it's easier. It's, you know, there's still very productive arguments to be had there. It's where I spend most of my intellectualizing argument time with games, right? But I think you're right. There's something more, it's almost like more mysterious, maybe more productive in a way to be poking at our Euros and thinking about, like, what did we say when we weren't thinking we were saying anything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what I mean by, like, this idea of kind of the body of colonial Euros taken together.
Right.
That's where you see pretty significant erasure. You know, lately I cannot advocate more that certain essays and podcasts I've done, I have had so much invaluable help from people who were... Kate, stop blowing your whistle. Oh, okay.
A false accusation, sir.
The baby is blowing a whistle. Okay. Well, I can't stop that. This is my life, listeners, and I adore my daughters, and I am a full-time dad in addition to everything else. And so unfortunately, they do take my mental bandwidth, and I don't have any idea what I was talking about. Oh, no, sensitivity readers. I have had so much invaluable help from, so for instance, that article that I mentioned on Martin Wallace's games, I was so grateful that I had a number of friends who were scholars, including a couple people of color who had direct connections to that topic, who were willing to read through it and help me with my own blind spots and be like, oh, you may have said something unintentionally insensitive right here, so maybe just change this. And that made the process a lot less painful than it could have been otherwise.
Right. And, you know, I actually am glad you brought that up. I think that's a good way to kind of start bringing this half of our discussion to a close before we pick up for part two, which is that, so you use a sensitivity reader, and you and I are both kind of interested in analyzing what we were accidentally saying in games. And I think this is a really good moment to talk about how, you know, we talk a lot about cancel culture right now. That's not our project. The idea of self-examination and criticism is just that, like, you criticize things because you care about them and you want to read into them and see where they could go, what they can mean. And, you know, we are also receptive to criticism because you can't be a critic without, you can't dish what you cannot take. You should not dish what you cannot take. Yeah, so right. I guess my feeling about that too is, so, like, I mean, how do you see yourself as critic pointing out potentially problematic cultural elements of games within our current context where people are so ready to kind of freak out about that?
You know, I get kind of annoyed, to be honest, when my own readers will take... So that same article, I don't mean to keep bringing it up. I guess,
no, it's good.
I guess I might as well use this marketing. Everyone, I'm bringing it up so you'll read it. The reason I bring that up is because when I wrote about those two Martin Wallace games, I really love both of them, actually. I think they're both good games. They're both very interesting games. I like one of them more than the other by a lot. But I still own and I still enjoy and I still play both of them. So I'm clearly not trying to tell anybody not to play it. That is not my goal. I'm not trying to get it canceled or whatever. And I think it's actually a little bit unfortunate that sometimes I'll mention this and a reader will say, well, now I'm never going to play that. And first of all, fair. You know, you have to gauge your own tolerances and, you have to gauge what your stomach can handle. And that's fine. Absolutely fine. In most topics, my stomach is ironclad. In others, it is not. I know my tolerances. You have to know yours. But there's also the level where, you know, this is a game that if I were ever to teach a course on historical board games, which is kind of a long-standing fantasy of mine, I would absolutely assign these games. Because they're great in terms of not only making historical arguments, but making arguments about what is the limitation of a game or what is ethical to put in a game. Or, you know, it can a game make a misstep even when it thinks it's making a good historical argument? It's kind of like when in a history class, if you do a directed reading, you won't only give like the best sources, you'll give challenging sources.
Right.
You know, your goal isn't just to be like, okay, here's like the best source of a period. You give a source and you're like, this one has some strong statements to make, and we're trying to teach you how to pick through a difficult document, you know, and even look at what the author's blind spots are and maybe where the author is lying to you. You know, you have to do that work to become a historian. To me, that's essential. And I would love for people to, you know, with this critical lens, go into a game and be able to enjoy it while also evaluating it critically and saying it did this well, but it did this poorly. And maybe its author wasn't sensitive enough to this particular thing. And maybe, but maybe he was very attuned to this other issue, while acknowledging that no game is going to be totally perfect because they're, you know, abstracted models of complicated situations. And I want us to be able to go into that. And so sometimes I do get frustrated when my readers read me being critical and they say, well, now I'm not going to play this game. And I'm going, no, I just want you to be critical of it. I want [S2] Right. [S1] You to see it in all of its flaws and its perfections and imperfections. And, you know, to me, that's exciting. To me, it doesn't come down to good, bad. It comes down [S2] Right. [S1] To many goods and many bads.
Yeah, and it has to be in the gray, I think. If you and I both share the fact that we have an academic past and present. And, you know, I think that for us, that means that, you know, my boyfriend gets mad at me all the time because I apparently just can't answer a yes or no question because I'm always like, well, if this is what you mean. but it's because there's pleasure in thinking through all the different possibilities and really thinking through something for me. And I think that that's the pleasure of criticism, right? Of creating it yourself, of reading it. It's supposed to make you see something in a different light. It's not supposed to make you never look at it again. It's supposed to make you look at it better.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's actually something I very much appreciate about your work. I think that is where you're going with it.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you to say. I'll have to work harder.
But for now, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm pretty straightforward. My website is spacebiff.com. I'm on Twitter at Dan Thoreau, which is Thorot is how you spell it. if you want to come and read some stuff and have a discussion about board games, I would love to do that. I love responding to thoughtful comments.
Fantastic. And those of you who are listening probably know I can be found anywhere on the internet as Beyond Solitaire. We will be back with another part of this discussion next week. Thank you so much for listening, and happy gaming, everybody.